Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 728. This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Star Wars Card Trader, the all-new official Star Wars digital trending card app available now for free on the App Store and Google Play. With new card releases every day, you can collect 30 years of official Star Wars trading cards from vintage classics to all new designs, including cards from Star Wars Episode 7. I really wish I had been more mindful when I was a kid. I just didn't know. We didn't know back then. Some people were smart enough to save their things. I was not one of those people. I played with stuff. It disappeared through several moves. Things got stuck together with chewing gum. It's really heartbreaking now when I think about it, but I had fun. I wouldn't necessarily need to have all those now because of the official Star Wars Trading Cards app. Download today for a limited time. Get 5 or more free packs per day. Star Wars Card Trader. These are the cards you're looking for. Fun, comfortable dates coming up in Texas and Buffalo and Toronto. Also Boise and Salt Lake City and Los Angeles. And a few more, go to funcomfortabletour.com for tickets and info. I also want to let you know, at midnight, starting the 8th of September, that'll be tomorrow, is all new. We're back in the studio after a two-week break, and we're going to be at 11 o'clock, so 11 p.m. now instead of midnight, just for 3 weeks, just before Trevor takes over the Daily Show. We're just grouting the gaps between Daily Shows at the moment, but pretty fun. We have a lot of great stuff planned, and then in a few weeks, we're doing a Bunches of Funches week, so 1 week where Ron Funches competes every day. In a couple of weeks, so that'll be great. Also on the Nerdist Community Corkboard, Andy writes, I'm a PhD student and a stand-up comedian. I have a website where I blog about fun, interesting studies in social psychology. It's called Social Psych Online. You can find it at socialpsychonline.com. I've written articles on the psychology of persuasion, how people think about themselves, psychological nature of social issues, and more. If you're interested in figuring out other people and knowing your own mind better, you'll find frequently updated material that's true to the scientific research, but also fun and easy to understand. All right. Well done, Andy, Social Psych Online. And then this one is from a listener who didn't write their name. We got a rad event coming up in Philadelphia, October 5th and 6th, 2015, called Death Salon Mutter Museum. It's our fifth Death Salon, and this one is being held in the most amazing medical oddities museum in the world, the Mutter Museum. I can attest to this. It's in Philadelphia, and it's incredible. I will go to the Mutter Museum every time I'm in Philadelphia. It's awesome. Even if you don't go for this event, you should still go visit the Mutter Museum. Anyway, we get together the best academics, artists, authors, death workers in one place and have them nerd out about their projects and art for a general audience to enjoy. This is our first East Coast event. The lineup's pretty incredible. Plus, we'll have the Dark Artisans Bazaar, which is an entire hall full of local artisans whose creations use death as inspiration. The full events and lineup can be found at deathsalon.org. Well done for that. And finally, this is an adorable Nerdist Community Corkboard from Matt Curtis and Amanda Lynn. My wife and I would like to announce that on Sunday, August 6th at 8 p.m., our daughter Eliza Jean Curtis was born. Hooray! I'm clapping with one hand on my leg. We'd like to thank you for the countless hours of entertainment Nerdist Network has provided, especially Chris, who spent our first wedding anniversary singing and performing in NYC. But since our daughter was conceived during an episode of our favorite show at midnight, you're welcome. We look forward to raising our first daughter the Nerdist way. Well done. Congratulations, Matt, Amanda, and Eliza. If you want your thing included, you can send it to events@nerdist.com for that. This episode is John Taffer. Promoting Bar Rescue, new episode Sunday nights on Spike. John was fucking awesome. Oh my God. You know, Matt Myra's been going off on Bar Rescue for a long time, and he and one of our At Midnight writers, Jordan Morris, who you may also know from Jordan Jesse Go with Jesse Thorne, they were on an episode of Bar Rescue. It's one of Matt's favorite shows, and so he was like, we gotta get John Taffer. And I was like, okay, let's get him on. And John was the goods. Dude is rad. So watch Bar Rescue. Follow John Taffer on Twitter. It's JONTAFFER. Watch Bar Rescue, and I know you will enjoy this podcast, which, by the way, was also brought to you by Automatic. Automatic is a tiny piece of hardware that brings your car into the 21st century. It works with almost any car made after 96. Installation takes seconds, and after pairing it with your phone, you will have access to a range of valuable information within minutes. Normally, you'd have to spend a shit ton of money on a car to tell you this stuff, but not only do you not have to do that, this will tell you more than even the high-end automobiles. Well, what does it do? Using the free mobile app, you can keep tabs on your driving habits, fuel expenses, find out what the check engine light means in plain English, automate your home using Nest, connect automatic to the apps you use every day to do everything from expense filing to fitness trackers, notify emergency services if you're in a crash. Buying at normal price is $99.95, but use the offer code NERDIST20, NERDIST the number 20, at checkout for 20% off, only $79.95, no subscription fees, free shipping. You're going to get it in 2 business days. You have a 45-day return policy. Works with iOS and Android. Automatic for your car. Here's NERDIST podcast number 728 with John Taffer in podcast rescue.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Great to be here.
Dude, what a crew. Oh,
yeah, this is...
Should have sold tickets.
I should have. Quick, it's not too late.
No.
Lock the door. I'm selling exit tickets, so...
Approach motel.
Yeah, exactly. You're not supposed to be able to check out, but I'm going to let you check out for a small fee. Are we all good? We're recording?
We're good. This is a big treat for me.
I know.
Chris.
Now, I over the Christmas holidays, I watched a marathon of your show, and knowing that Matt... Mm-hmm. Watches a lot. There are a lot of shows, and I know what shows Matt loves. And I go, "Have you seen this show, Bar Rescue?" And he's like, "I fucking love that. John Taffer's a genius. Oh my god, I just want to be on that show so bad." And then he ended up getting to be on the show,
and he got to do an episode for the first ever haunted bar.
Yeah. What?
Yeah, it's
how haunted was the bar, man?
Listen, when it comes out, you all are gonna. It's gonna rise to the top of the bar rescue episode. It's gonna.
Are you bar rescuing bar rescue?
It's gonna pass. It's gonna pass the pirates. It's gonna go up, up, up. It's gonna be the best because it combines all the things you love about reality television: now, ghosts and bars.
While Matt was gushing about you, I think words like the real deal. he's been in it. The man knows what he's talking about. He's not fucking around. Like, it was very...
I'm passionate about Bar Rescue.
When did you first discover Bar Rescue, Matthew?
I think when it premiered. I was just way on board, because I'm a fan of the reality show ilk where someone is doing something shittily. And someone who knows what they're doing.
Let's face it, Matt. You like watching people get embarrassed.
Yes.
I mean, let's understand what's going on here.
Yes, John.
You love
yes.
it when I abuse them.
Yes.
And that's what you love. You love to see people mutilated, weakened, destroyed. You're an asshole. Let's
yeah.
face it.
Yay.
Wow. Let's put it out there, right?
Because you've already rescued our show.
Yeah. Holy shit.
Unbelievable.
Oh, my God.
That was amazing. I fucking know this guy for years. I never realized that.
But I nailed it, didn't I?
I nailed it fucking on the head.
That's why he's good. He gets it.
Behind that smiling exterior.
Yes.
He's the fucking devil. I'm
telling you. Yes. He's the worst.
So how would you rescue Matt?
He's the worst.
If Matt was an episode of Bar Rescue, what would you do to him?
You know, Matt might be a walkout, but you know.
Taffer walks. Hashtag Taffer walks.
You know, pocket protector might help. We were talking about that earlier.
Just get that going in there.
Oh, you fucking God. Shave for a change. Maybe that would make
sense. Yeah, we all listen, have that same.
Listen. If you wore more than $6 worth of clothes, that might go a long way.
You know why? He's too busy buying collector guitars.
Man. Well, you know, I have a collection. It's good to go. This is from Brooks Brothers. This is a quality.
I have a Jimi Hendrix guitar at home that I bought in 1980 when I was running a troubadour from Buddy Miles.
Wait, holy shit.
That's a true story. And Buddy Miles got in drug trouble. And when Hendrix died, he inherited, I can't remember the exact numbers, about 28 of his guitars from the Manhattan apartment.
Uh-huh.
And he got in drug trouble. I was running a troubadour at the time. It was a thing of timing, and I wound up with that guitar, and it's sitting in my office at home
right now. Holy shit. Is it signed or anything? Or you just
no, it's but I have a photograph of him in it, and I have a letter of authenticity from Buddy Miles, and the serial number tracks back to his estate. So
that's unbelievable.
Sometimes drugs do pay off when you get to guitars.
For the people around.
Yes, if you're on the other side of the fence, it can pay off really well. Yes.
So how long?
Hang on. What is it, like a 68 Strat?
No, that's what's amazing about it. Uh-huh. It's a Swedish guitar, a Hagstrom.
Oh, I know Hagstrom.
It's a hollow body guitar. It's a 1957, and I'm told that's the guitar that he used in the song Blue House.
Wow, that's fucking awesome.
Which was a different kind of sound for him. Mm-hmm. You know, he normally played a Strat, but he did not play a Strat in that. But I don't know that to be a fact. That's what I was told.
What years were you running a Troubadour?
I ran a Troubadour in the early 80s.
Yeah.
You know, so when I ran a Troubadour, it was the Dead Kennedy days, Black Flag, Adamant, Fear.
Holy shit.
You know, those were all the bands back in those days. Everybody was pogoing, swinging fucking chains on the floor, you know, menage pits. I mean, that was all the stuff that was going on when I ran
That's
a Troubadour
amazing.
Back in those days. But also, the Knack. I mean, you want to talk about conflicting.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, Black Flag and the Knack popped back then. My Sharona.
Yeah.
Pop band. They were a Troubadour band. So, you know, they really popped out of the Troubadour at the time. So, you know, the new age rock thing was going on, and at the same time, the punk thing was going on. It was sort of interesting.
Wow.
That's pretty incredible.
See?
He knows what he's doing.
Did you start at the Troubadour, or where?
No, actually, I was a musician when I came to California. I played the drums, and you know, I was gigging in various bands, and I played in the Troubadour, and I developed a friendship with Doug Weston. And one day he just threw the fucking keyring at me. He said, and I picked up the keyring and started running a Troubadour. And I remember when I ran a Troubadour that I had to, we were behind on our bills. Right, Doug used a lot of the proceeds for recreational purposes back then.
Sure.
And rest in peace, Doug. I used to leave the money in a safe in the floor every night so I could get my liquor delivery in the morning, right? Because I had to pay cash or I wouldn't get booze. And Doug would sneak in every night and take the fucking money. So I'd come in the morning and there'd be no money. And that's how I started running the Troubadour and trying to turn it around.
How did you write the Troubadour?
You know, I righted the Troubadour. It was the first time I ever did anything like that. I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. But I was the first person who ever ran the Troubadour that had the balls to say no to somebody. No, you can't eat that fucking steak if you don't pay for it. No, you can't take that bottle of Cuervo home. No, you can't. So,
this guy's no fun. Doug Weston let his shit on the floor.
Fuck this. I don't want to work for this guy. But you know, it was just a couple of things like that. And then I coordinated at the time the 25th anniversary.
Wow.
And we got a lot of people to come back. So at the time, you know, a lot of the original people who started years earlier, like the Jackson Browns of the world.
Yeah.
I remember Carlin came back and did a night for us.
Holy shit.
For the 25th anniversary. And you know, that gave us a jolt of cash that got us over the hump. But when I took over the Troubadour, there were about 2 inches of water on the floor in the kitchen. Because we had plumbing issues.
Wow.
And we didn't have the money to fix it. So I got a bunch of pallets and I threw them on the floor and we walked over the water. It was like a wooden bridge system that went through the kitchen. But we did what we had to do
to
make
it. Smart.
You know?
Oh my God. So I did.
And then after three bands a day, I so burned down on it, I went down the street to Barney's Beanery and worked at Barney's Beanery for a couple of years. And then I moved on.
Did you turn that place around too?
Well, Barney's Beanery's always been successful. I mean, Barney's Beanery's been here since 1920. But, you know, I remember the great days of Barney's Beanery. I mean, when real celebrities were there and ashtrays with white powder were passing up and down the bar. It was a very different time then, you know. But Barney's was a scene, man.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, thinking about what Los Angeles and the Sunset Strip would have been like in the 70s and the 80s, it almost terrifies me. Like, it almost feels... Like, how did everyone not die? Like, you know, it's just like...
It's amazing.
It was just snowing cocaine and people, you know... I mean, it just feels like... If you not only turned a bunch of places around, you survived a cultural war zone in a way.
And you fucked all day long. Back in those days, it was a whole different thing.
Well, sure, because of all the drugs and stuff, you're able to...
Absolutely. But those are interesting days. You know, it's funny. I was talking to Matt earlier, and I haven't remembered this story for a long time. But the strangest thing that ever happened to me in a bar happened in a Troubadour. I got to tell this story.
Please.
I don't think I've ever told this story before.
Please.
In the late 70s, early 80s, there was a football game where the Washington Redskins beat the Dallas Cowboys in the last 30 seconds or so of a game. Would have put them either in the playoffs or the Super Bowl. I can't remember. This particular day, Doug Weston gave the club to the American Indians. Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So we had about 800 Indians in the Troubadour. We had Indian comics, Indian drummers, Indian dancers, Indian art, Indian fashion. It was really cool. The football game had ended about 30 minutes before this moment, and a good friend of mine who was an attorney for an agency here in town, walks through the front door of the Troubadour expecting the normal rock and roll crowd and screams at the top of his lungs, "Those fucking Redskins!" I looked up, and from 20 feet away, he said it a second time, "Those fucking Redskins!" And they broke his collarbone.
Sure. Oh, well, of course.
Jesus now, Christ.
Once the misunderstanding was understood, everybody signed his body cast. No, his shoulder cast a few days later. But, you know, when people say to me, what was the most bizarre thing? I mean, that was a bizarre moment.
That is almost, if I saw that on a sitcom, I'd be like, come on.
It's like something out of like an airplane.
Or, but you can't write something like that.
Yeah, exactly. So,
wow.
But the Troubadour was some crazy days, man.
Still there, too. It's Troubadour still there.
I'm guessing it's got to be 60 years old now.
I saw a show there 2 weeks ago. I saw the Dead Milkmen play. Probably
still a great venue, right?
Yeah, great. It's one of my favorite venues. Yeah. Not a bad spot to stand. No. It's like you can see the stage wherever you are.
Yeah, the balcony's cool. Audio's great. Yeah.
It's just a fan. I've been going to shows there since I moved
just
out
intimate
here.
Enough.
Yeah, it's just a perfect.
I feel like Steve Martin maybe did one of his albums at the Troubadour.
He did a special. He did one of his HBO specials.
One of the specials at the Troubadour, I think.
Right. Hall & Oates just did one there recently. There's been a bunch of them shot at the Troubadour over the years. It was a great venue.
So what brought you out? Like, so after the Beanery, did you go, well, fuck Los Angeles, I'm going to Vegas?
No, actually, I didn't wind up in Vegas until years later.
Oh, wow.
I wound up on the East Coast, and I was doing venues on the East Coast. I opened Pulsations after that. And Pulsations for Leon Altimos was a nightclub outside of Philadelphia that had a 4.5-ton spaceship that flew into the room and deposited a $400,000 robot in the dance floor. And our robot... Our robot...
This is a real thing!
And our robot was in Rocky IV.
Oh, that's the robot he has.
Pulsar. And, you know, that, in my view, is the greatest nightclub, you know, I've ever been involved in. When we opened that nightclub and that spaceship came out and the doors opened and the fog billowed out and this alien robot came out of the spaceship, 4,000 people were standing there with their mouths hanging open. And it was like a fucking religious experience. And I looked at the robot operator who was standing next to me and my tech guys who were all standing around me because everything was remote controlled. Yeah. And we all had tears going down our faces. It was amazing to see. And it was my greatest nightclub moment in all my years of doing this and all the venues I've worked. I saw technology create almost a religious moment. It was so fucking powerful and overwhelming. And that was Pulsations. And when we opened Pulsations... Even in today's terms, this is astronomical. We did $647,000 our first week open.
Jesus Christ.
Holy shit.
And we did that in about 1983.
Oh, my God.
And the sad thing about Pulsations is opening night, a light fixture fell off the ceiling and killed somebody and injured a few others.
Oh, shit.
So, you know, that I learned a lot of lessons from that. I learned a lot about nightclubs, and I learned that from the rest of my life, I put 5 cables on everything that hung in the ceiling.
Yeah. Sure.
But, you know, contractors, you know, weren't inspected by the cities, and obviously I had nothing to do with it. It was all contractors and inspectors. But it showed me how much responsibility means in a bar.
Sure.
Not only with regard to what you serve people and what you give them, but the things that you hang over them.
Right.
You know, slippery floors, unlit staircases. Yeah, I learned about all of these things young. And, you know, the greatest responsibility that I have when you walk into a place of mine is to keep you safe.
Mm-hmm.
Period. And there's no responsibility greater than that. And, you know, even the Troubadour taught me that.
I mean, it's just having a musician's background and then immediately flipping that and having the most responsible job in a club. Did you feel any sense of, oh, I really, I wanted to be a drummer. I don't know. I mean, like, at what point did you feel like, fuck, I'm a grown-up now and I got a grown-up's job?
Being a drummer's great, don't get me wrong. But being a boss ain't bad either.
I guess that's not bad. Yeah.
My fucking world. You know? Yeah. Welcome to it.
From being in bands, though, and like playing different venues, did you already kind of have a thing? It's like, you know, this would be so much better if this was like this. Like,
that's an amazing question because I own the only patent ever issued by the federal government for the managing of music to achieve a desired ambiance in a hospitality property. And that comes from my Troubadour days. I learned very young that if I took 10 songs and changed the order of those songs, I could affect an entirely new experience.
Sure.
And you higher and you lower, peak you at a different level. I learned that if beats per minute were too low, too long, you get bored and leave. If they're too high, too long, you get fried and leave. I learned the proper ratios of curves. I learned all of the music mix elements, how much distorted guitar versus keyboard versus male versus female. I even learned that if there's gang members in a bar, I can eradicate them in 3 weeks musically. Every third song is a female vocalist.
What?
Oh, wow. And they are gone in 3 to 4 weeks.
That's crazy.
So music defines everything.
How do you
don't go
that
to a
out?
Bar that's because I'm a fucking nutcase. You don't go to a bar that isn't cool.
That's right.
So how do I define that? Well, you know, I can make a dive bar that has an uncool interior really hip with music.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So music is important. So those days in the Troubadour taught me so much about energy and watching these bands and the science of keeping you longer through beats per minute and music mitts and left turns and things that we call the weave. Which were different approaches to defining music, and I'm a fucking nutcase, man.
And, as a customer, as a consumer, you should probably never notice those things, right? You just experience it, and for whatever reason, you go, "Oh, this place is really cool. We should come back here." Without going, every third song is this. Like you should not notice the code.
Yeah, what I call set your watch. Well, it's 12:02. They're playing such and such a song. No, you can't do that. So the challenge is to do it differently every night,
right?
And to really make it organic and make it flow almost like an organism.
Yeah.
That's driving the room. But my job is to make you dance more than you normally would, talk to more people than you normally would, have more fun than you normally would. My job is to make a guy like Matt, who's inherently boring, and make him have a good time today. That's my job.
You can't make him have a good time, John. It's impossible. Can you explain a little bit of the science behind velvet roping to me? Because I feel like I've seen so many clubs where it's like, you just put that up so people think they should get in. Then you get inside, there's no one in the club.
Exactly right. If I set up the plants outside and the red carpet and the stanchions and the whole thing, what's the subliminal message sent?
Oh,
they're getting ready for a big crowd tonight.
Yeah.
If I don't do that, I got no chance at anyone. So, and then the trick is, now I'm going to hold 20 people in front. How about that? You're standing on line for 15 minutes and you walk in and there's nobody fucking there. So now you're really pissed because you know what I'm doing.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's, and Vegas in particular... Vegas, if you have an establishment like this, I can't think of a better place that you would want to be because people, I mean, like I've been to, you know, I'm not a nightclub person, but I've been a couple times to, you know, like Taos or whatever.
Taos
is in New Mexico. Sorry, but the idea that people just go, oh, it's Vegas, I'm on vacation, I'll spend $300 on bottle service,
fantasy land.
Yeah, and it's not a big deal. Like anywhere else in the country, is there anywhere else comparable to that?
Nothing. Listen to this. I do the top 100 when I ran the nightclub and bar convention, and the number one grossing nightclub in the world is Excess in Wynn.
Oh, yeah.
$110 million a year, one venue.
Yeah. I've been in that place before. It's got the dancing poles, and they bring in the
beautiful.
DJs.
Oh,
and the...
yeah. And then Hakkasan is number two at $104 fucking million.
Jesus
and
Christ.
And then Waukee is three at about $85 million.
Because they get you for like $50 cover charges, right? And the drinks are expensive.
You pay $2,500 for a bottle of vodka.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I guess when you look at the numbers, they're like, well, yeah, of course it's $100 million a year.
I mean, you can walk
but
out to the lobby and get that much cheaper.
But in Vegas, you're going to cut loose.
Yeah.
You know, you go to Vegas, you're there to have a good time.
Yeah.
You're going to spend more, do more, drink more, eat more, party more. And that's what Vegas is. You should. You're going there for that reason. I mean, that's
right,
what Vegas
guys.
Is all about.
Ready for the
so how
he's getting married in Vegas in October.
Yeah, I know.
So, you know, I got to give him a hell of a night before.
Oh, my God. Where's Matt? Matt's dead. Oh, my God.
He's under something called the Taffer table.
So what is it about these specific, like how does a place catch buzz and hold on to an audience before? At what point does it have to... evolve and, you know, become a new place under the same management? Because I knew Brent Boldhouse when I was first starting out. Brent runs one of the big, I don't know.
Big venues.
What does he run? He runs one of the big promotion companies in town.
Boldhouse.
Oh.
But they were acquired, or he took over the one that runs the sushi place on Sunset and Vine.
Oh, Kabuki?
Stark. I think he runs Stark.
So he's a promoter. He fills the rooms.
He's a promoter. He fills the rooms. And, you know, there always seem to be that, like, okay, this place is cool for a little while, and now it's a whole different place, but it's secretly the same owner. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So how do you know when to do that, when to cut loose, how you build the buzz?
Well, you know, it's you got to track your trends. There are certain things that are key. 20% of the people in a building at any given time should be new customers, never there before.
Mm-hmm.
If it's less than 20%, you're going to be empty in 3 months.
Wow.
Because people get bored, they move on. You have to keep infusing 20% new bodies every week. So when we go in, we do market research, we determine that we have to have about 20% new people, 80% repeats. If I have more than 20% new people, then I have an issue. I don't have enough repeats. So if I'm not 80% people who have been here before, the bar sucks. Something ain't right. I'm not getting them back. So I have to assess the music, the service, the pricing, the environment. I have to determine everything to get back to that 80% frequency factor, if you will.
Wow.
If I'm at 90% frequency and I don't have new customers, and I got a marketing issue. I got to infuse new faces. You're not going to go to a bar if the same girls are there every week and there's no new ones.
Yeah.
Well, not you. Maybe you. Yeah.
It's fine. It's fine, John. It's fine. Right.
But he's getting married. He can't do that. So,
yeah.
So all of these little sciences play big time into it, Chris. And it's those little subtleties that keep it vibrant. And I ask you a question. Have you ever seen a bar with 200 women in it go broke? So that's a big part of it as well. So, you know, I got to look at that brand vibrancy, the messaging that we send out, you know, curiosity. I got to feed your ego when you come in some way, because you're not going to go to a bar that you think is unimportant, because that makes you unimportant.
Right.
You're not going to sit in a seat that's unimportant, that makes you unimportant.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not going to stand in a part of the room that's unimportant, that makes you unimportant. Yeah. You're not going to listen to unimportant music either.
Right.
So my job is to make every part of it seem important. And that's where you get your own personal relevancy from it. And it's completely manipulative.
Yeah, so this is playing with people's vanity, pretty much.
Oh, no question about it. That's what I do every day long. My job is to make you handsomer, sexier, smarter, funnier. You're all those things when you come to my place.
Right. So then how did you get involved with Bar Rescue? And at what point was this your idea? Or did someone come to you and go, John, let's make a show about this shit.
It's actually
you're a weird numbers freak.
Yes. Actually, somebody heard me give a speech at a convention and said, you got to be on fucking TV, man. So I wrote up about a 4-paragraph treatment for a show that was originally called On the Rocks.
Mm-hmm.
And I came out to L.A. and I pitched it to 3 companies. And I was, I meet with a friend of mine who at the time ran a television for Paramount, who said to me, I said to him, I want to do this show. He looks at me and goes, you will never fucking be on television. He says, you're too fucking old, man. You'll never be. You got to be like 25 years old to do this shit. As soon as he said that to me, there was no fucking way in the world I wasn't going to do this show.
Yeah. Right.
So I turned every stone. I wrote this up, and then I went and I did a sizzle reel. And I shot it in Hermosa Beach, pretty much 3 minutes of me screaming and yelling at people. Brought the sizzle reel to 3 companies. I got 3 offers.
Oh, my gosh.
Literally in days, Chris. So now I did my background checks on the 3 companies, and I picked 3 Ball Entertainment.
I know 3 Ball.
Yeah. And it wasn't the best deal, but it was the best company.
Right.
Yeah. Now, when I did my homework on Todd Nelson and J.D. Roth and all the people there and the work that they did and the show that they did and the production teams, I just said, that's the right company for me. So I signed with 3 Ball. 4 days after I signed with 3 Ball, Spike picked up the show. 4 fucking days.
Wow.
So from the time I wrote up the first piece of paper to the time the series premiered was less than a year.
Wow.
Which is unbelievable timing.
Did you send a piece?
But the show went through 4 names.
So On the Rocks.
Bars on the Brink.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Bar Rehab.
Okay.
And then Bar Rescue.
I like On the Rocks.
On the Rocks.
Too wedding-like. When we tested Marriage on the Rocks, it didn't quite send the message.
Yeah, I mean, you're basically talking to the guy that sees the Matrix code behind everything. And probably was like, fuck it, Bar Rescue tells you exactly what
that
the show
was
is.
The Food Network knockoff was called On the Rocks.
Which we got a kick out of because we rejected the name, and candidly, I rejected the show.
My question is,
I'll be honest with you.
So your friend at Paramount, you obviously sent him a piece of shit in a box with a bow around it, right?
Actually, I sent him a box of black roses was actually, I believe, what
that's
said.
Amazing.
That's a joke.
Yeah, of course. So there's something specifically about your personality that someone says, you can't do this, and you go, oh, okay, I will do this now.
Yeah.
And where do you think that comes from?
My mother. I think it's all Freudian in some way. No, I mean, my mother was a freaking ball buster.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm a ball buster. And she didn't tolerate anything other than, you know, excellence. You know, my family was successful where I grew up. You know, my grandfather, my uncle, my father were all very successful. And there was no question that I had to be, period. End of discussion. Mm. So
you went into music.
I said, fuck you to all of them. Picked up a drumstick and went to Hollywood. That's what I did.
Not just music, a drum.
Yeah.
And then I wound up being a corporate business guy in the end anyway.
You know, but just striving for excellence doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be insightful. I mean, that's a whole other...
No, that's a little deep. And I talk about it in my book, Raise the Bar, a little bit. You know, when you really get down to it, my mother was tough with a ridiculous temper.
Mm-hmm.
So if I didn't manage her reactions, there were consequences.
Mm. Of course.
So when the veins popped up on her throat, I suddenly had to be humorous.
You understood.
I had to be cute. So I own the term reaction management. I own it.
That's a genius term.
And it's a principle in my book. And the principle is if you can manage the reactions of those around you, you'll be a fucking millionaire. You'll have whatever you want in life. So at a young age, when I was 12, 13, 14 years old, I learned to manage subliminally. It wasn't conscious. The reactions of her.
Mm-hmm. As a survival mechanism.
As a survival mechanism, you bet. And before I knew it, when I was 15, 16 years old, if I was talking to you and let's say you crossed your arms, I'll change in the middle of a sentence because I know I lost you.
Right.
I just have learned body language and I've learned how people react and what they do. So I have this way of shifting to manage your reactions to me every moment. And you saw it during Bar Rescue. And, you know, it's this intuitiveness that I think I learned, as you said, in the survival mode when I was young. Now it's completely subliminal. And when I talk to somebody and I sense they're disconnecting, again, I'll change topics mid-sentence. I'll come in on you. I'll change my voice tone. I'll change my voice tone. You know, I'll work it because your reactions to what I'm saying are paramount to me.
Sure, and most people don't. I mean, there is a whole science now, a whole field of study behind micro-reactions where they will break down. And if it's not something that you understand, and you might go, "Oh, that guy's smiling," they go, "No, he's baring his teeth."
That's right.
Which is which means that he is making an aggressive statement right now. I go, "It looks like he's smiling." Nah, because you can see the. And so it's that I am so endlessly fascinated by that as a field of study, because particularly as a comedian, you do get some. You do learn how to read a room. You know when the energy, and you know how to push and pull. But on an interpersonal level, it'd be really, really interesting. So there's more of this in your book, I assume?
Yeah, there is, and I talk about it a little more. But, you know, if you watch Bar Rescue, the firehouse episode with Jack's fire department was the most intense moment of reaction management for me. There was a scene behind the bar where I was screaming at Jimmy, and he was right in front of me, and this is one big dude. And this guy could flatten me in a heartbeat. And I am in front of 100 people insulting the fuck out of this guy.
Yeah.
Queens. Sunnyside, Queens. And he is about to belt me in the mouth. But if I don't stay with this, I am not going to change him.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't give up. So I'm watching his eyes and I'm watching his pupils. And they're going to dilate before he hits me. And for a split second, I started to lose him. And I got him back again, and his arms were hanging at his side. And I grabbed his wrist for a second, tightly. And in that second, I took control of it, and his pupils went back down again. And that was the closest I ever came to being hit in Bar Rescue, and I knew it every second.
Wow.
I knew how close to the line I was. I knew I was at the line, and I knew exactly when to pull off. And that was one of the most intense scenes in Bar Rescue to me ever. And it was all eye to eye, Chris.
Yeah.
You know, and there was nothing else in that room but his eyes and mine.
And then maybe, hopefully, in the end, he understood, like, I'm doing.
Well, I got my hug in the end, buddy.
Do you really? I mean, if you really.
And they respect me for that in the end.
So it. You know, I think on the surface, people are like, oh, it's a show, and it's a guy, and he goes in, and he helps. But because it seems like you so passionately really do care about the process and helping people not – essentially get out of their own way and not make dumb mistakes, it sounds like you really give a shit about when you go in there, because these people are asking for help, and you – as long as they listen to you, you can help them.
Their last chance, man. I mean, they're going to close in 2 weeks. You hear them say it. They're in debt hundreds of thousands of dollars. They have children. You know, parents' retirements are on the line, grandparents. This is serious. These are human lives on the line. I take it fucking seriously.
And what's the most common? Is it that people rush into the bar business without really understanding what they're doing, and then like, oh, a year later, we're all completely fucked?
Yeah, they jump into it for social reasons.
Right.
I was saying to Matt earlier, it's like if you were into drugs, don't become a pharmacist. You
right,
know?
Right.
Probably not the best idea.
How many? Did you have specific questions about the show that you?
What do you think of it, Matt? Did the reality of it surprise you?
Yes, I will say that. So,
oh, was Jordan not coming?
Jordan, well, he had to go back to the office, but we were talking a little bit beforehand.
Okay.
But Jordan Morris and I went down to help out John. We did some recon for him, and I will say that I was, we're both extraordinarily surprised at how real everything you're seeing on television is, to the to the point where he is outside the bar in the Suburban. Like, it's like all the things that, even in my head, knowing television production, I was like, oh, well, they're just going to drop that in later and they'll go shoot it 40 miles away. You know, pick it up later. It was happening right outside. He was watching us while we were in the bar. Nothing set up. I mean, you know, they just say, okay, go in and order drinks and just be yourselves and sit at the bar and we'll watch.
If you like it, act that way. If you don't like it, act that
yeah.
way.
Right. And that's what we did, and it was amazing. And then John fucking bursts in the bar, and it's the happiest moment of my life because John Taffer is standing 20 feet away yelling at a shitty bartender, and Jordan and I are just like two kids at Christmas, like going, oh my God, it's really happening, and it's like, and he's just on point, and it's there, and it's all happening, and I was like, so I was genuinely surprised in the carpentry tent is outside the bar because they gotta fucking get going on building that as soon as John comes up with the concept, and I'm like, oh, holy fuck, you guys do this in 5 days. It's not like,
but can you change someone's life in 5 days? Because
no, but you can change their business.
You can change their business, but you still can't change the fundamental essence of a human being and the way that they make decisions.
If you're aware,
that's why I'm so heavy. That's why I'm so heavy.
Yeah,
I mean, the fact is, there's a method. I'm going to start with pride.
Sure.
I want to appeal to your pride. You want to be successful. You want to have money. If that doesn't work, I'm going to go to fear. Mm-hmm. What happens when you lose your fucking house? What happens when this business closes? What are you going to do then? That doesn't work. Then I'll work to your family. Pictures
sure.
of your kids. Pictures of your mother. Whatever.
So you're ghosts work, of Christmas futuring them.
I am. If that doesn't work, then it's boot camp time, man. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to, because you believe you're right. So I have to make you doubt yourself. That's what I must accomplish.
But how do these people think they're right when their businesses are failing?
That's a good
they're
question.
Fucking delusional.
If they were mental giants, I wouldn't be there in the first place in many cases. But the fact of the matter is they're not great decision makers.
Right.
So that's why I'm there. So, you know, I have to make you doubt yourself just a little bit for a second.
Mm-hmm.
And your brain cracks open and then I walk in. So my view on it with Bar Rescue, and the reason why I'm so aggressive, is if I say don't do this, do that, don't do that, do this, they're going to fucking do it again anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But I got to change the way you think. And if I can change the way you think, then I'll change what you do. And there's independent websites to track our success. And
yeah.
we're tracking at about, what, 80% success factor now?
Holy
yeah.
shit.
Yeah. We could go look at go look at Kitchen Nightmares. It's at like 12. It's like, it's the percentage difference is amazing.
Yeah, we track it close to 80, 75% if I'm wrong, Chris. But, you know, we're really up there in our success factor because it's so fucking real to me, man. The cameras disappear.
What did you, when you went into the bar and you ordered, what was the problem with the bar?
There were plenty of problems with the bar, Chris.
Tell him the big problem, Matt.
As a student of John Taffer, what was your initial...
Chris, I got
to
tell you.
I'm waiting to report back your recon. Tell me
problem,
everything they're doing wrong.
The biggest
back.
Problem with this bar was a ghost.
Okay.
It's all fucking right. haunted, man.
All right.
That was literally the problem with this bar. It was a haunted bar.
Now, what if I am skeptical about there being a ghost in the bar?
Well, I think you just tune in to Bar Rescue and find out what they find out. But also, I'll say the drinks were shitty.
Yep.
The bartender was a little loopy.
Mm-hmm.
The people around weren't terribly enjoyable either. The lighting was awful. The carpet was dirty. Bar was sticky. Smelled bad. The pours weren't good at all.
You were the best looking guy in the room?
Believe it or not. No. I'll say yes. I was better looking than Jordan.
He didn't even hear him defend himself. Is there something, though, about... I mean, I guess maybe it has to be a little more engineered, but there is something about a divey bar that can be attractive. So
oh,
what's
no question.
The, what's
yeah,
the
if it's
line,
done right.
But what's the line between, oh, this place is cool because it's kind of shitty, and, oh, this place is just shitty?
How do you define hipness? It's really hard.
Mm-hmm.
How do you make something hip? I mean, I'm on the Nerdist talking hip.
Yes.
The Nerdist is about as hip as you get. But that's what's unique about it. How did the Nerdist become hip?
Me.
You can't define
Jonah.
You can't define that, Jonah. I mean, so, you know, you put all the elements together. You put the pieces together in the bar business, sexiness, you know, intimacy, warmth.
Mm-hmm.
You put all these elements together, and at the end of the day, it's the people that make it cool. So that's seeding.
Mm-hmm.
So if I seed the room with the right people, then its reputation is set in stone by the people that are there.
Mm-hmm.
What makes a dive bar cool? Cool people in it.
Right.
So I seed the room, and I can change the whole future of the bar.
Oh wow! So you basically there are times when you've actually corralled a crowd and been like, go in there.
Oh, more than that, I'll give 300 girls gift cards.
Oh wow! Mm.
I'll give them money to go in and spend the first 4 days hanging out there. I mean, I will seed the room. If I need jackets and ties, I will pay people to go in. It's no different than seat fillers in an awards show.
What's your favorite kind of room to put together?
Ah, that's a great question. I love bars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just cool bars where we hang out, you know, talk, interact together. You know, that to me is what's great. You know, the second public building ever built in America was a bar. First was a church. They were called public houses back then.
Mm-hmm.
And there were no city centers. There were no town halls. There were no hotel meeting rooms. So all of our laws were created in bars. The marriages were created in bars. The corporations were formed in bars. It's the fiber of America. But bars then weren't about drinking. They were about an environment.
Sure.
You know, they were centerpiece of the community. And bars back then, pubs would have little walls in them called snugs.
Oh, yeah.
And snugs were between tables. And we did that in the Packies episode of Bar Rescue. Was so a priest could be sitting at one table as a bunch of rowdy guys was sitting at another, and there was a little wall in between them.
Yeah.
So that everybody could go to the pub, and it was inclusive, not exclusive.
Yeah.
Right.
It's the fiber of America.
Well, and you're also talking about a broader idea that when, you know, because I have meetings with people all the time, and they want to, like, oh, how do we advertise our thing? And I go, well, that's the wrong question. You should be talking about how to build your community, because you're in the community building. You can't just advertise shit at people that they don't know or give a fuck about. Like, you have to,
of course.
You have to unite people and show them that you're listening and that you care. And that, I mean, and you're just talking about a very real world and much older expression of that.
And you know, to me, reactions carries through to everything. You don't do a radio podcast, or you do you create reactions. You do it through the podcast. Mm. Your product isn't the podcast. Your product is the reactions that you achieve through it. Right?
I guess that's very true.
If you don't achieve the reactions, you have no podcast.
That's right.
I don't sell food and beverages. I sell reactions. I achieve it through food and beverage. I don't play music. I play reactions. I achieve it through music. I understand that the ultimate product that I sell is a human reaction.
That's a great...
And everything that I do is to achieve that reaction. That's why you're successful. Is you guys create great reactions in people that relate to them. They like it. They smile. They have emotional reactions. The more reactions you create, the more fucking money you'll make. That's the world.
He's a
That's
genius.
Reaction management in its essence. Everything. And when people say, I market for a living. No, you don't. You create reactions. You achieve it through marketing. Because if the marketing doesn't create a reaction, it sucks.
Right.
Yeah.
And if you put a plate on the table and you don't sit up and react to it, it sucks.
Right.
And when you take a bite, if you don't react to it, it sucks.
Right.
So let's understand what business we're in. We are in the business of human reactions. And he or she who achieves the best reaction fucking wins, man. End of story.
So you're saying it's better to be polarizing than neutralizing.
In a sense, sometimes, you bet.
Yeah.
Because you can get noticed that way.
Sure. I mean, I'm not someone who subscribes to the idea of like, all press is good press. Like, I think good press is good press.
I'm with you, buddy. I don't love the turtleneck tweets either, you know? Eyes popping out of my head tweets.
How has social media, how did that start to change? When did you start noticing the way that people are interacting, you know, on smartphones, online, and social media in relation to your business?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've actually, being on TV, I don't make any more money than I used to. So my business was vibrant, and my days were full, and my calendars were full. So being on TV has made me not do the other things that I used to do.
Right.
So my income isn't greater, but my reach is far greater.
Of course.
So, you know, it's astonishing to me that I'm a celebrity. You know, it's astonishing to me that, you know, that I'm famous and that people, you know, will tweet and communicate with me. And, you know, on my birthday, I got thousands and thousands of messages. I mean, that's really heartwarming that somebody would take the time to write a note to me, and that I can connect or inspire.
Sure.
And I get 300-400 emails a month from bars around the country that say, you know, you inspired me, you helped me. It's fucking cool. So I have been given a unique platform where I can actually inspire and help people. and most reality stars, we laugh, are going to go to hell. I might actually make it to heaven. I'm actually doing good stuff.
You might make it to heaven and go, all right, that's dirty. You need to
Yeah, well, this is no fucking entryway. Yeah. What are you doing here? I expected big fucking gates and stuff.
Doorman, no velvet rope.
Doorman's got to go.
Right. No red carpet? What the fuck?
Yeah. What's that guy's name, Pete? This guy's a piece of shit. You got to get rid of him.
Shave his beard.
Yeah, shave his beard. Scaring off the kids. Yeah. But
Jesus, I want to see 200 women in here by tomorrow.
So, I got to tell you, I had a moment with Matt and Jordan that was funny. I'm standing behind a bar, screaming and yelling at this owner, who's blaming his failure on a ghost.
Sure.
And for a moment, I look out across the bar.
It's the greatest episode ever.
And Chris, so while I'm doing this, for a split second, I look across the bar. And there's about 60 customers in the bar, and they're all sitting there with their mouths hanging open. They can't believe what they're seeing. They're sitting there. And then Matt and Jordan are sitting on their bar stools, crying with laughter. They are falling off the chairs. They cannot contain themselves. I mean, I'm convinced he pissed in his pants. Everybody else is in horror. They are loving every second of it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It was the greatest thing ever. Although,
it was like watching you're watching live bar rescue.
It was like if I ever got to go to a taping of Frasier, it would have been the greatest thing ever. But this is my next best thing, is this bar rescue. But I got to ask, the bar, did you put a butt funnel in?
No butt funnel.
Oh,
butt
man.
Funnels always go with dance floors.
Okay.
What's a butt funnel?
Oh, please, John. You're looking at the man who invented the butt funnel.
Please.
A butt funnel is an entrance to a dance floor that's about 28 to 30 inches wide.
Okay.
So when you go through it, you got to rub up against a person who is also going through.
Oh, okay.
So, nice looking girl. You're approaching the butt funnel.
Yep.
You have a choice to make. Front to front, or back to back, or front to back.
Sure.
So if you decide front to front and enter the butt funnel and she spins, you're now front to back.
Right.
Right? Hence the butt funnel.
Got it. Got it.
So it's either the breast funnel, the butt funnel, but what it does is it forces people to be close, rub up against each other, eye contact, interaction. Before you know it, they're buying breakfast.
This man once built a double butt funnel. It was
and a double deep butt funnel.
Oh man, was that a treat?
No, you can't do it. It's too much.
I'm gonna do it. Double butt funnel.
Is it has now that everyone has a voice, and you know, everyone has Yelp, and everyone has a million different ways to rate, talk about word of mouth. Obviously, it's more important than ever. Does that feel like any more responsibility, or does it just feel like, no, it's just a natural extension of the thing that we were already doing? If the place is good, that's all going to shake out fine. Or do you focus on that too?
You know, it creates accountability, which is fucking cool.
Right.
You know, you have accountability. You know how many downloads you get.
Right.
Your downloads go down, you got a freaking problem. You know.
Of course.
You know, in the past, a lot of bars and restaurants operated without accountability. Now, when you have a bad experience, you post it, you say it, you put it out there. It's actually good.
Yeah.
And what it does is it holds them accountable to some standard, and it allows you to be informed as a consumer. So I think it's had a really positive effect on the industry.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, it is interesting too. Just like how much even I just will look at Yelp before I go somewhere, just to sort of like see, or like if I'm in a town I don't know, I'll always pull up Yelp.
I mean, when we're out of town, of course,
yeah.
I will always. I go, I'm looking for a breakfast place. I sort by rating, and you do this kind of little math in your head where you go, well. It has 4 stars, but only 10 reviews. This one has 3.5 stars, but it's got, you know, 1,000 reviews.
Yeah. And so the 10 reviews with the owner's family.
Yeah, exactly.
And you also, like, I do the thing now, too, where I go, where I have the L.A. market of Yelp in my head versus the New York market. Like, a 4-star in New York would be like a 7-star in Los Angeles.
Yes, maybe an 8.
Yeah. Like, it's just like New York is so much more, I don't know, free to voice their opinion, and you have to be really good in New York to get a great Yelp rating. So, like, when you're out in New York and you are looking and all around you is just 3 stars, you're fucking, I'm going to be hungry. I'm not.
Hey, we're New Yorkers. We're going to tell you to go fuck yourself.
Well, not only that, but in New York, you have so many more immediate options. In L.A., you have to get in your car. It's very intentional.
I mean, there's 4 pizza places on every block.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Exactly. So it's there.
And all of them are called Ray's. What is going on?
Original Ray's, Ray's original, the Ray's original, original, the Ray's.
There's 7. I looked it up. Yeah.
Is there a city that is not a good place to run a bar in, or do you feel like, no, in any community you can figure it out?
You know, it's funny. Years ago, I did a big venue in Nashville, And when I'm doing my market research, I'm with the entertainment writer of the Tennessean newspaper, who says to me, John, you're nuts. People don't drink here. This is the Bible Belt. You're not going to do big money in the bar business here. So I go into the databases, and I do research on alcohol consumption. And the alcohol consumption in Nashville, Tennessee at the time was 11.3% higher than the national average. Yeah. Well, somebody's fucking drinking.
Right. Right.
So what they say and what they do are often very different.
Yeah. Of course.
I remember when the whole meat thing broke out. Nobody, oh, don't eat meat, don't eat meat. Meat sales went up during that time period. What we say and what we do are different. And my job is to sort it out. I don't want you to do what you say you're going to do. I need you to actually do it.
Yeah.
So I have to focus on the reality of moving bodies, butts in seats, and causing people to actually act. And that's a challenge.
Do you have, of the episodes of Bar Rescue that have aired, do you have a favorite remodel? Like, do you have one that you were like, well, we fucking nailed that?
There's actually a few. 38th floor is one of my favorites.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I love that concept. And that room was really thin. So I put a bunch of large video monitors vertically on the wall, put columns between it, and made them look like the windows of an office building, named the bar the 38th floor, put in a webcam system so you're looking down from the 38th floor at downtown San Francisco.
Oh, that's right.
And the name of the bar was the 38th floor, and you walked through an elevator to get to it.
Yeah, but it's just I thought that was a cool concept.
And that concept we created in 10 minutes after Recon that night. We were in trouble on that one. You know, Jack's Firehouse, I thought, was a great one. When we took a fire truck, we cut it up, we put the front behind the bar, and we used pieces of the fire truck all over there. But I'm proud of all of them, really, Matt. You know, I don't think there's a bad one in a lot.
Wow.
So you are you – but you must be hard on yourself. I mean, you couldn't be – you couldn't achieve the level that you're at if you weren't kind of hard on yourself.
Oh, no. Sometimes. There's not ever a time that I don't walk out that I say, gee, I could have. Maybe I should have. But, you know, with Bar Rescue, and here's the insider look. I do Recon. At the end of Recon, we turn the cameras off. You know this, Matt. Mm-hmm. We take the employees out of the building. I go in. I design the bar that night.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, I'm signing off on bar stools, wallpapers, colors. We're designing the bar day two. By the end of the second day, morning of the third day, I have to have the logos signed off on because I got to have the sign company make the signs. I got to have the exterior plan done. I got to have the furniture ordered and all the interior done. The recipes, the menus, the graphics, everything has to be done by the morning of day three. At the night of day three, at 9 o'clock at night, I turn it over to my construction team. They give it back to me 36 hours later. You know that, Matt.
Yeah.
You were there.
It happens.
And we do it every week. So I have about an hour to come up with a concept, design a bar, do all the elements, and now I've done it 92 times.
Shit.
And every time I say to myself, I got to be out of these fucking ideas. How am I going to come up with the 93rd?
Yeah.
But we walk in, and you know, there's always something, a beam across the building, a wall, something about it that gives me a what I call a creative thread.
Sure.
One idea that I can carry through to the walls, the looks, the logos. And what makes a great bar is that one thread that pulls all the elements together.
And you don't really have time to waste second guessing yourself, so you have to just make quick decisions.
No, I'll be cocky. I think my first guess is better than a lot of other people's second guess when it comes to the bar business.
Yeah.
I'm one cocky son of a bitch, huh?
Yeah, but you know what? You back it up with bar science.
I got to ask you, though, if there's a thing I've been upset about at bars lately, some of my favorite kind of divey bars, a place I just go and get drinks with friends, every bar is seemingly trying to figure out the whole mixology thing.
Yes.
And so now every bar has their own little like mixed drink menu where it's basically a science project.
Snobbery?
Yeah. And it's, the wait time for drinks is now extending at bars when they're never used to. It's making me furious. It's like to wait for just a beer.
They got to spank the mint. They got to wait
don't
a second and a half between each spank.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, here's what's interesting. So let's say it takes 30 seconds to make a cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
But in a mixology bar, it takes, let's say, 2 minutes to make the cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
So my production is now 25%. Of what it was.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So if I don't charge 300% more for that same drink, I'm going to lose money.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
You with me?
That makes so much sense.
Yeah, because
I'll generate less dollars.
You can only turn around so many in a night. Yeah.
And at the end of the day, bars are about sales per foot.
Oh, wow.
Right? That's the ultimate measurement. So my job is to create revenue, dollars per foot.
Yeah.
And to do that, I got to produce production.
Right.
And I got to get product out. So a lot of these mixology bars are screwing themselves. Don't do something that takes three times longer unless you can charge three times the price.
Right.
The economics don't work.
Yeah.
And then you get frustrated and say, fuck it. I'll spank my own mint.
Yeah. Yeah. There's been so many bars that, like, everyone, like, all my friends will be like, if only they had, like, a beer line. Like, you know, just like you go to this guy and he just pours you your drink right away.
Well, that's why we do a lot of shot tubs and things. We'll put girls in beer tubs and such. We'll put them right by the front door.
Yeah.
So we get it in your hand right away. We take the stress off the bar.
Yeah.
You know, sort of reminded me of the difference. I remember, right around the time Chipotle launched, Baja Fresh was also kind of launching around the same time.
No microwaves at Baja Fresh.
Well, I read an article about, and it's very similar to what you're saying.
It's all pre-microwaved.
But I read an article about why Chipotle took off and why Baja Fresh, and part of it was that, you know, Chipotle was a simple 1-2-3 menu, and Baja Fresh was kind of a confusing. People didn't really know what they were ordering or getting, and so they were spending more time, trying to figure out, like, oh, I mean, I guess Chipotle's just like, do you want this, this, or this? We'll make it right here on the line as you go down.
Yeah,
and it was the efficiency and the simplicity that people are,
how would you like these three ingredients?
Well, I don't want to answer 30 fucking questions. People, just give me my goddamn sandwich.
Yeah. People think they want. There's a weird balance between people think they want choice, but when you give them too much choice, they become overwhelmed and stressed because they don't want to. They spend their whole lives having to make decisions, and they just don't want to have to make big decisions all the time.
And you know, it's fascinating when you look at what's happening in the restaurant world today. McDonald's sales, drop 2-4% every month.
Mm.
I mean, they have a serious crisis, that company, and all millennials are moving to fast casual. Chipotle,
sure,
Panera, all of those brands, and they're spending about $10 at fast casual, whereas they used to spend $5 at fast food.
Right.
So they're spending twice the price, and marketers like me analyze this and say why, and it's story. For example, organic, fresh, locally produced,
right? Well, you can
food with integrity.
Yeah.
All of these fast casuals have a story that millennials relate to.
Right.
And then you look at another brand in some of the fast food restaurants, they can't say any of that. No organic, no fresh, no special blends, no this. So marketing of restaurants today is all about story.
Yeah.
And having something that you connect with. And that's why those brands are doing so well.
Huh. Yeah. Well, I mean, story is the most important thing for anything
today.
Because there are limitless choices for everything at all times. And that's what – and so then I think people naturally go – oh, well, I relate to that because my personality is attached to that as opposed to just a big, a big kind of a sterile chain where people are like, oh, I don't understand that because that's not – because people are conditioned now because the entire internet will just algorithmically tell people like, here's what you already like. People expect that everything should be a personal experience for them.
Mm. We're going through a bit of a marketing revolution right now. When we look at the fact that legacy brands, and I don't want to beat on any one company like McDonald's and stuff, millennials have no loyalty to these brands.
Right.
Yeah. They'll jump on a new brand like Shake Shack in a heartbeat.
Oh, yeah.
So the fact that you're an old brand of 50 years means fucking nothing anymore.
Right.
It's what are you going to do for me today?
Right.
What's the story today? That's a big shift in the whole marketing universe because legacy brands don't mean anything
anymore. Yeah, it's no more of like, we've been serving burgers since 1955. Like,
fuck yourself, old man. Yeah. That's exactly right. Yeah. I'm going to go to the guy who just started yesterday. Yeah. But that's one big thing. And then, of course, the whole premise of the phone, and mobile.
Yeah.
And the fact that you can't advertise the way you used to anymore. I can't communicate with people the way I used to anymore. Millennials look at their phones up to about 230 times a day. How do we get on those phones? You guys have figured that out. Obviously, I can listen to you on my phone all the time. But, how do we get advertising messaging on phones and how do we connect with people now? We are literally going through a revolution now.
Sure.
And it's a real challenge for, the marketing professionals.
It is, because a lot of it is, like traditional media, it was a very one-sided conversation because they had the luxury of only having only a couple of outlets.
Yeah.
And so people, if you want entertainment, you had to watch those outlets. And now there's like
so many options.
There's too many options. Like there's everywhere. So, now it is like that you do have to have a conversation with people because you have to engage them on a personal level.
You got to connect.
Do you think
back to reaction management?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Copyright. Do you think that the way we all sort of look at millennials is like these people that will just – that are sort of into the screen experience versus an actual experience? Do you think that will sort of affect – them maybe not wanting to go out?
Well, I worry about two things.
Yeah.
When I was younger, we didn't have this stuff.
Mm.
So we looked in each other's eyes human interaction was important. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I feel your presence. You sure. feel mine. There's a connection when we're in a room together. We don't feel that through a screen.
No.
So what's happened is today more communication happens digitally than interpersonally, and that worries me. I'm in a business of interpersonal relationships.
Sure.
Right.
I don't want people ordering their food and beverages on a tablet. I want them looking into somebody's eyes.
Right.
I'm scared that if a tablet gets in the middle of my customers and my employees, that the whole industry is going to disappear.
Right.
Because I don't sell drinks. I don't sell food. I sell social interaction.
Sure. Yeah.
So I'm worried that, you know, we're growing up with less and less of that, Matt.
Right.
And that people are not going to be as interactively sensitive or capable.
Yeah. So do you start playing into that? Do you go, well, the trend seems to be that people are interacting with their devices, so we need to find ways to do that? Or do you go, no, I'm gonna try to force people to have these types of personal experiences because on some level human beings need that and will be an alternative to what, you know, like what people are doing with their faces in their phones?
Yeah, you know, that's a really astute question, and it's a challenge for me all the time. What technologies do I embrace? And what technologies do I fear?
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And, you know, which technologies will I not embrace? Absolutely. You know, I believe hell will freeze over before I put a tablet between a server, a bartender, and a customer. That just violates every premise that I know. You know, if I wasn't looking in your eyes and in this room together, you and I would never have the relationship
we have
now. And the bar business is about relationships.
Yeah.
Not interaction. Relationships. Connections.
Why cheers are so popular.
Cheers is the best. Guys, cheers, Frasier.
That's a good point. We bring up cheers. I used to
go to Frasier all the time.
Yeah?
Yeah. Kelsey was a friend of mine. I used to go sit and watch shoes all the time.
John Taffer's the greatest human being alive.
His mother used to go to every set.
That's amazing.
You know, Kelsey was amazing. When you go to Frasier, every time Kelsey walked out on stage, he had this presence that was just remarkable. He was really something.
That's right.
God. What would you have changed about the Cheers bar?
I would have made him collect some fucking money. And I got to tell you, you know, if Norm sat at the end of that bar, one beer would not have gotten him 2 hours of sitting there.
Oh, fuck.
I mean, think about it. They never made money.
I wrote a thing for the Nerdist YouTube channel that we never ended up making, which was you going to rescue the Mos Eisley Cantina from Star Wars.
You know, there's a Facebook page for that.
Is there really?
Somebody created a Facebook page to have me do this. And
I mentioned it. I must have mentioned it, but it was about,
maybe you caused
about 2 years ago.
Because we had the Cantina set.
Yeah, we had the Cantina set built, and I was like, we were trying to figure out uses for it, and I was like, fucking John Taffer should rescue the bar and like
where's
flip
the
out,
set?
Flip
we
out about
sold it
them
to,
like
we sold it to StarWars.com.
Oh really?
Yeah,
but I wanted him to like flip out about them not serving droids and like that's half your customer base out the door. And I was gonna
you got gonna, this guy shooting that guy over there.
And
the
just
fuck
screaming.
This band, no one can understand a fucking word.
You got a dead green guy in the corner.
Clean up the bodies. Number one rule.
That was one of my dreams, but it never panned out. But you know what? The idea exists, and if anyone wants to rebuild
hope,
that set, yeah, I'll still hope.
I'm being told you have a hard out because you have a hard, where are you guys off to today?
I am off actually to Lance Bass.
Oh, nice.
Oh, nice.
Well, do you want to plug? Obviously, you want to plug Bar Rescue? You want to plug your book?
No, I'm doing a book signing tonight at Barnes & Noble at the Grove.
Oh,
a DVD
fun.
Signing. You know, the first ever Bar Rescue DVD came out.
Nice.
And Blu-ray or just DVD?
Just
what's
DVD?
Wrong with you guys?
You're not John Taffer. You can't yell at people.
I got to shut him down, Matt.
Yeah.
You know, we normally do season one, season two, season three. These are my toughest rescues from all three seasons. So it's a really cool DVD.
Awesome.
So I'm doing a signing tonight at Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
And my app, I'm really proud to say, Bar HQ is one of the highest downloaded B2B apps in the world. I put together an app for free for the bar business.
Yeah.
Does their scheduling for them, all their social media management. They pull 60
Shit.
Promotions down for free. Push a button, the promotions go to their social channels, go to their employees' channels. And it's, you know, sort of my gift to the bar.
Uh-huh. Yeah. My friends, Roberta's in Brooklyn, they use that for their
schedule. It's called Bar HQ.
And,
you know, I love it. So it's available for free for download. And anybody who's in the bar business that doesn't have it, it's crazy.
That's fantastic. Maybe one of these days we'll try to pin you down and get you to tell us, like, here's how to get more people to come out to your live shows. Like, that would be a nice.
I smell a Nerdist bar.
What?
Somewhere.
See what I'm saying?
Matt would have to run it. I don't drink, so I don't.
I don't
which probably actually make me the perfect bar runner because I'm never gonna.
You said you're the perfect guy.
Yeah.
You and me, buddy.
Yeah.
You know who ran Cheers? Sam Malone.
Sam Malone.
He didn't
totally
drink.
Totally sober. He was addicted to fucking ladies a lot, though.
Hey, you know what? Wait,
he was a relief pitcher.
Yeah.
Pitcher. Yeah.
John Taffer, it was a pleasure. Great. Thank you so much for being here. Really nice to meet you.
Same here, buddy. We'll see you again soon.
Please. Yeah. And enjoy your burrito.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.